him and his girlfriend bury the kid in the backyard.
These crimes are horrific. Whatever this child's life was supposed to be, you make sure it didn't happen.
I knew I was sick or evil or both.
220 dispatch, he jumped. We have fire out here. Yeah, well, where is he in the water?
In custody at 324.
I have to imagine that at some point you got in the internet and said, how do I bury a body?
I am so very sorry. I deserve whatever I get because of what I have done.
Just a quick warning. This video will contain explicit and sexual content. The video will tell some gruesome details about murder victims and crimes committed by a very disturbed individual. This is not a topic that can be treaded lightly, and as such, viewer discretion is advised.
Hi everybody, it's Lady Curious, joined by As the Raven Dreams. We are doing a collab video about a man named
Alexander Sasha Bikushkin, also known as the Chessboard Killer and the Bitsa Park Maniac, is a Russian serial killer who killed 48 confirmed people, but has stated that his kill count is 61 between the years of 1992 and 2006. Alex was active in Moscow's Bitsa Park, where a number of the victims' bodies were found. Alex is known as Russia's most prolific serial killer of all time.
But we're just going to call him Alex throughout this entire video. Alex was born on April 9th, 1974 in Moscow, Russia, in the suburbs. He lived with his mother, Natasha, his younger half-sister, her husband, and their son in a two-bedroom apartment on the fifth floor. Alex slept on a couch in the first bedroom, which doubled as a living room. Natasha slept alone on a queen-size bed 10 feet from her son. Natasha's husband, Alex's father, moved out before Alex turned one. His parents divorced when he was quite young, and he grew up without a father figure to guide him. His childhood was a difficult and a troubled one. But in the master bedroom slept his younger half-sister, Katya, now 27, and her husband, also named Alexander, and their son, 6-year-old Sergei. Their apartment building was a 6-minute walk from the north end of Bitsa Park. Bitsa Park is a long, rolling forest filled with trees, streams, and clearings. In the winter, it's popular with cross-country skiers. The park is enormous, encompassing more than 2,700 acres. Just think about that, because New York Central Park only covers 843 acres. So that park is massive. That just blows my mind. Surrounding it are tens of thousands of people living in sprawling, rusting apartment blocks speckled with satellite dishes. Many people call this part of Moscow grim concrete, a half hour by metro, the center of the city, and they literally would call this asshole of the world. In the late 1990s, the area around the park became known as a hunting ground for a man the press called the Bitsa Park Maniac. People would disappear into the woods in the park, into the tall birch trees just far enough away from the road that if you were going to hide behind them, it made you nearly invisible. Natasha Bishkushkin, Alex's mother, has lived in the same apartment since she was 11 years old that they live in now. And that was in 1963. The 5-story buildings were the Soviet Union's first large-scale public housing projects. They were dank, charmless, and overflowing with tenants, but they were the first single-family homes most of these people had ever lived in. They were an improvement. Now, Alex is remembered to have been initially social child. However, this changed following an incident which Alex fell backwards off a swing, which then the swing struck him in his forehead as it swung back. Experts speculated that this event damaged the frontal cortex of Alex's brain, the area of the brain that controls problem solving, impulse regulation, and personality traits such as aggression. Since he was still a very young child, the damage would have been more severe, as a child's forehead provides only a fraction of the protection from the brain compared to an adult. Following this accident, Alex frequently became hostile and impulsive. Experts would attribute this injury to the driving force behind his rage, and perhaps the reason he was so eager to kill. But Alex's brutality and depravity went far beyond most people's understanding. When he was younger, due to his behavior, his mother decided to transfer him from the mainstream public school he had been attending to one for children with learning disabilities. Prior to this transfer, children from the mainstream school were known to have physically and verbally bullied Alex, referring to him as that retard. That's so sad, y'all. He also had issue with his brain. Well, this abuse served to intensify his anger.
Располагал себе. То есть, если вот, допустим, так вот, то есть не был таким неотщепенцем, таким, как вот бывает изгои некоторые там.
Upon reaching early adolescence, his maternal grandfather recognized that Alex was highly intelligent and felt that his talents were being wasted as he wasn't involved in any activities at home and the school he was enrolled in focused more on overcoming disability than on promoting achievement. Alex was taught how to play chess, and after demonstrating his ability, he was introduced to the games against elderly men who played publicly in bits of park. An outstanding chess player, he found a channel for his aggression when dominating the chessboard and all of his games. However, he continued to be bullied by mainstream school children and suffered an emotional blow when, towards the end of his adolescence, his grandfather passed away. According to reports, the death of his grandfather greatly affected him. In an effort to both dull the pain of the loss as well as to calm his severe aggression tendencies, he began to consume large quantities of vodka. He continued to play chess both at home and at Bista Park, now joining the other older men in drinking vodka. Though, unlike them, he could play without being greatly affected by the alcohol. It was at this time that Alex began to develop a more sinister hobby that, at the time, remained unknown to anyone. It was said whenever he knew he was going to encounter children, he would take a video camera along and proceed to threaten them. On one occasion that has since been made public, he held a young child by one leg upside down and said to the camera, "You are in my power now. I'm going to drop you from the window, and you will fall 15 meters to your death." He then watched these videos repeatedly to reaffirm his power. Yeah, that's disgusting. That's a big red flag. However, by 1992, this practice had become insufficient to satisfy his urges. In the news and around the neighborhood, the infamous Bista Park maniac was talked about everywhere, a faceless beast that grabbed people in the night. His description, although limited by police knowledge, was plastered on every news outlet it could be. Somehow, however, people kept disappearing. The public envisioned a monster, an animal of a man, potentially more than one man, hiding around every corner, living in the shadows, preying on the weak. But in reality, Alex Bakushkin was working days at a grocery store, making small talk with the hundreds of people who passed through the register every day. His co-workers always referred to him as a quiet, perhaps a little strange, but certainly not dangerous, until he attempted to lure one of them into his killing grounds. Russian media have speculated that Alex was motivated in part by a competition with another notorious Russian serial killer, Andrei Chikatilo, who was convicted of killing 50 people, two children, and young women over a 12-year period. Alex said his aim was to kill 64 people, the number of squares on a chessboard. He later recanted this statement, saying that he would have continued killing indefinitely if he had not been stopped. Now, before I actually turn this over to my colleague and friend as the Raven Dreams to go ahead and let you know about all of his horrible murders, I spent hours trying to figure out the truth of which victim was what number. Many of the sources from the internet varied from the truth, and some had more victims confirmed than others, so I am so sorry that these are not spot on. I really tried my best. Even Alex himself couldn't get it straight. I do know his final number of kills was 61, and that includes the three that got lucky and survived.
Alex's first confirmed murder occurred on the 27th of July in 1992, when he was aged 18. He arranged to meet his classmates, Mikhail Odichuk, in Bitsa Park to jointly hatch a plan to kill 64 people. However, when they had arrived at the meeting point, Mikhail changed his mind and told Alex that he no longer wanted to go through with their plan. Feeling teased by his best friend, Alex pulled a hammer out of his bag and delivered about 20 blows to Mikhail's head, killing him. Once Mikhail was dead, Alex deposited his body near a sewer entrance at Bitsa Park, then returned to his mother's apartment a short distance away. When Mikhail's body was discovered the following day, Moscow police opened an investigation. Witness testimony provided to the police stated that Mikhail was last seen with Alex, walking in the direction of the park. Alex was arrested at his mother's home on the 30th of July and taken to Moscow police station for questioning. When asked about his schedule on the day of Mikhail's murder, Alex confirmed having met with Mikhail, but claimed to have left him unharmed in the park. With no evidence tying him to the murder, Alex was released. In September of 1992, Alex was romantically rejected by Olga A., his 18-year-old neighbor, as she was already in a relationship with a man named Sergei B. Sergei's body was later discovered outside his apartment building. It has been suggested that Alex, furious that Olga rejected him, went to Sergei's apartment and threw him out of a window, causing him to fall several meters to his death. Police investigation ruled Sergei's death a suicide. However, it was confirmed by Alex that he indeed committed Sergei's murder by getting him blackout drunk and then throwing him out of his window. Sergei would have been his second and unconfirmed murder, allegedly.
He must have understood that once he started killing, not dabbling or experimenting, but really killing and killing wantonly, he wouldn't stop. He must have been enthralled by this idea, but perhaps he was afraid of it too. He may have even tried to squash it. There is a story, unverified, that in late 2001 or early 2002, Alex wandered into a police station near the park and declared, for all to hear, that he killed people, not once or sometimes, but regularly, because that is what I do, Alex supposedly said. As the story goes on, the cops laughed in Alex's face, called him a drunk, and told him to go home, which he did. In any event, his 9-year hiatus ended on May 17th, 2001, when he killed his next victim. Alex would approach his victims in Vista Park. The vast majority of them were elderly, homeless people. He would offer to share a drink of vodka and then kill them, typically by striking the back of their skull with a hammer or a bottle. Although he was also alleged to have pushed his victims into the sewage canal to drown.
On the 17th of May in 2001, Alex was in Vista Park playing chess with a 52-year-old man named Yevgeny Pronin. At the end of their game, he invited Yevgeny to take a walk with him, claiming it was the anniversary of his dog's death and that he wanted to visit the grave in Vista Park. Yevgeny accompanied him to an isolated area in Vista Park where Alex pulled out a bottle of vodka and offered him a drink. The men made a toast to the dog, after which Alex struck the man in the head with the bottle. Once Yevgeny was dead, Alex threw his body into a nearby well. Yevgeny was his second confirmed victim. On the 23rd of May in 2001, Vyacheslav Klimov, 64 years old, was Alex's third confirmed victim. June 22nd of 2001, Alex's fourth confirmed victim was a man named Yuri, but there were no other details on who he was, nor how he died. On June 26th of 2001, Nikolai Tikhimorov was Alex's fifth confirmed victim. On the 29th of June 2001, a man named Nikolai Filipov, 72 years old, was Alex's sixth confirmed victim. On July 22nd, 2001, a man named Oleg Lvov, 49 years old, was Alex's seventh confirmed victim. July the 13th, 2001, a man named Gennady Safonov, 61 years of age, was the eighth confirmed victim. On July 14th of 2001, Sergei Pavlov, 44 years of age, was the ninth confirmed victim of the chessboard killer. On July 20th, 2001, Viktor Alistratov, of the age 45, became Alex's 10th confirmed victim. On July 21st, 2001, a man named Viktor Volkov, 54 years of age, was the 11th confirmed victim. On July 26th, 2001, Andrei Konovaltsev, 22 years old, was then the 12th confirmed victim of the chessboard killer. Family members waited the requisite 3 days and then filed a missing persons report with the police. But the police, who are known for drinking and taking bribes, rarely did anything. No one made any connections. And then, as the disappearances mounted, the families found one another. There was fear, which led to speculation. No one knew anything, therefore everybody did. The babushkas wondered aloud about the vanishing Lyoshas, Nikolais, Victors. Lyosha Zhidai, where's Lyosha? Nashio Robativi Kimkakaks, he found a job in Kimki. Da, ladna, on pianitsa, bullshit, he's a drunk. Vazmozno numer, maybe he died. The rumors metastasized. Could it be a psychiatric patient who'd escaped from the institution in the park? The nearby mental institute would allow some of their patients to freely roam the park, but had a curfew. Could it be the Chechens? The Mafia?
10 of his victims lived in the same four-building complex where he lived. 4 of them from Building 2, 2 were from Building 4, next door to his building, 3 from Building 6, and 1 from Building 8.
By early or mid-2003, the families had begun to wonder whether it was someone they knew. There were too many connections between the missing. By then, the count was approaching 30. No one had come back. No one expected much to be done about it either. And that's because the people on Kherson'skaya, like many of the Russian peasants in their crumbling urban hives, understood that in their country, only certain people mattered, and that they were not among them. On January 18th of 2002, unidentified Vyacheslav was the 13th confirmed victim of Alex. On January 19th of 2002, Andrew Volovsky, at age 42, became Alex's 14th confirmed victim. On February the 13th, a man named Yuri Chumakov, 48 years of age, was the 15th confirmed victim. February 23rd, Mariah Verakiva, 19, survived, and was supposed to be Alex's 16th confirmed victim. But she survived his attack.
Alex tried to kill Maria Verakiva, a pregnant woman. She was 8 months pregnant. He pushed her down the well. But she somehow managed to climb out and get to a hospital, where she reportedly told the police about the attack.
Була заповнена вода, я стала захлюбуватися. На мені була зимня куртка, так як время було зимнє. І сильний стук води понес мене по течению. Я розставила руки, ноги, держалася об трубу, содрала все, значит, до крови. Була не в силах вибратися оттуда. Я стояла всю ніч по пояс в этой ледяной воде. Мені було плохо, больно. Мне было страшно, я не знаю, мне было холодно, в конце концов. Мне было до такой степени больно, что я не хотела жить на тот момент.
The cops asked for Maria's registration papers. And, you know, back then, millions of Russians citizens live in Moscow. I meant jobs outside the capital are scarce. But Maria said she didn't have any papers. The cop that came to see her told her that if she stayed quiet about her attack, they'd overlook her illegal habitation. Maria stayed quiet. She was scared. She needed her job. She was about to have a baby. This police officer is just so corrupt and lazy. If he did his job like he was supposed to, about 40 people would have been alive today. This officer was fired. That is all that I know that happened to him. But can you believe that if he would have taken her story serious and stopped being a lazy and didn't want to write reports and stuff, that more than 40 people would be alive today? He could have stopped 40 people. And I know they fired him. I'm not sure if they did anything other, more drastic to him, but they should have. He should be in jail.
On February 27th of 2002, Vera Zakharova, age 48, became Alex's 17th confirmed victim. On the 7th of March the same year, a man named Boris Nesterov, 46 years old, became the 18th confirmed victim. On March 8th, 2002, Alexei Fedorov, age 41, sadly became Alex's 19th confirmed victim.
Who used to drink? They have drunk together. Petushkin gained credibility of the victim and invited him to get drunk again in the woods on the next day.
Я говорю, Алёш, ну куда же ты сейчас уходишь-то, я говорю. Мамуся ненадолго, я прогуляюсь.
And on March 10th, Mikhail Lobov, age 13, would have been his 20th murder victim, but survived the attack.
It's unlikely he knew McCall, who didn't come from one of the apartment houses. And it's unclear exactly where they met, probably near the metro station, where the kids with leather jackets and multiple piercings drank vodka from plastic cups and hung out next to the flower stands and dumpling kiosk. But once the pair entered the forest, Alex did not stray from his script. A 20-minute slog through the snowy woods, cigarettes, some camaraderie. You respect me, and I respect you, so let's drink. Then, like before, a surprise blow to the head, followed by a shove down the well. Alex turned and exited the park, like no big deal, but didn't notice that McCall's jacket had caught on a piece of metal inside the well. the boy managed to crawl out. Once outside the park, he found a cop and reported the incident. The cop told McCall to go home. A week later, McCall was back at the metro station when he happened to see Alex. He would tell everyone in court that it didn't matter what McCall claimed, because nobody would believe a punk who hung out at a metro stations. Which is true, everywhere, and especially in Russia. But McCall began screaming and clawing at his hair, and he grabbed one of the officers standing outside the station and started pointing and shouting and telling the cops they had to do something. And still, they did nothing. Again, he was told to leave.
On August 24th, 2002, a man named German Chervyakov, age 43, was Alex's 21st confirmed victim. September 13th, Nikolai Ilinsky, 40 years of age, was the 22nd confirmed victim. On September 25th of 2002, a man named Vyacheslav Miniev was the 23rd confirmed victim of this psycho. On the 30th of September, Sergei Fedorov, 42 years of age, was the 24th confirmed victim. On November 2nd, 2002, a man named Alexei Pushkov, 46 years of age, became Alex's 25th confirmed victim. On November 12th, the same year, a man named Valery Domatov became the 26th confirmed victim. On an unspecified date, a victim named Olga allegedly became the 27th unconfirmed victim of Alex. On March the 13th of 2003, Alexei Fatkulin, age 72 years old, became Alex's 27th confirmed victim. And on March 27th, it was Viktor Ilyin to become Alex's 28th confirmed victim. On April 4th of 2003, Igor Kashtanov was Alex's 29th confirmed victim. And on April 6th, Oleg Boyarov was the 30th confirmed victim of the chessboard killer. On the 10th of May, Vasily Stanovoy, age 40, was Alex's 31st confirmed victim. On May 12th, Sergei Chudin, at age 45, became Alex's 32nd confirmed victim. Sergei, a middle-aged man who disappeared in late spring of 2003, was a typical target. Alex would wait for hours until his victims were all alone. Alex eyed Sergei for at least an hour before he made his move. The man had been smoking and drinking on a bench, legs crossed, sat next to a bus stop around the corner from Alex's apartment. It was warm outside, and there were too many people around. But finally, everyone except Sergei disappeared, heading inside their apartments or ducking into the grocery stores. Alex, then filled with an enormous excitement, made his approach. A few minutes later, the men were strolling down the two-lane road toward Bitsa Park. It was early evening, the trees loomed over the power lines, and a red taupe sky stretched across the forest. Sergei was in a sour mood. As they neared the park, Alex tried to cheer him up. Alex was worried that the foul-smelling, inebriated little man would change his mind and turn around, depriving him of what he believed to be his. A balloon of rage began to expand inside him. As they were about to enter the woods, Alex asked the man what he would wish for if he were granted one wish. "To stop drinking," the man said. "Well, I promise you," Alex replied. "Today will be the day you stop drinking." He always took his victims to one of two wells that connected to the city's vast sewer system. As they trudged through the park, Sergei didn't ask any question about where they were going or why. He just walked, or more likely, stumbled. Sometimes, when Alex and his prey would reach the well, he would propose a toast to his dead dog. In this case, he did not say what he and Sergei discussed before he attacked, but he did describe how he did it. He removed his weapon sometimes a hammer, sometimes a wrench with a tool used for removing nails. In this case, he didn't specify. From his jacket, and he struck Sergei on the head hard, but not hard enough to kill him. His 33rd confirmed victim is unknown, and has never been found. On August the 30th of 2003, Igor Kudryavtsev was Alex's 34th confirmed victim. On October the 14th of 2003, Vladimir Fomin was the unfortunate 35th confirmed victim of Alex. On November 14th, 2003, Vladimir Fotosov, age 44, was Alex's 36th confirmed victim. On the 15th of November, Konstantin Polikarpov, 31, survived, but would have been Alex's 37th confirmed murder victim. He did, however, survive this horrible attack, but there are no details about his story of survival.
He would always attack from behind to take the victim by surprise and avoid spilling blood on his clothes, widened his range of victims, beginning to target younger men, women, and children.
On February 22, 2005, Peter Dudukin, age 57, became Alex's 38th confirmed victim. June 8th, Andrei Maslov, age 40, was Alex's 39th confirmed victim. On September 28th, Yuri Kuznetsov, 46 years old, was the 40th confirmed victim. On October 15th of 2005, Nikolai Vorobyev, age 31, became Alex's 41st confirmed victim. And on November 16th of 2005, Nikolai Zakharchenko, age 63, was Alex's 42nd confirmed victim. Nikolai Zakharchenko, ex-cop, turned up dead in the woods. Zakharchenko was the first person who hadn't just gone missing, but was discovered, tagged, and determined beyond any doubt to have been murdered. This is not the most important fact about him, however. The most important fact about Nikolai is that he was the 42nd victim. But after Zakharchenko, the conflict inside Alex began to seethe and overflow. Now he killed recklessly. He no longer pushed his victims down the well. He left bodies in the snow, in the mud, tucked between trees.
Beginning with Nikolai, the ex-cop, and continuing into early 2006, the people up and down the icy boulevards began to grasp the threads connecting the people who had vanished. That was when the terror began rippling through the apartment blocks and metro stations that hugged the park, which is now a haunting place. Children were forbidden to venture into the woods. People talked about hearing shouts and cries echoing through the trees. That was when the moniker, the Vista Park Maniac, entered the local lexicon, and then a national discourse, and then the global airwaves, the internet message boards brimming with anonymous posters, waxing cryptic about the invisible monster prowling the wilds of southern Moscow.
On November 21st of 2005, Oleg Lavrenko, age 36, was Alex's 43rd confirmed victim. November 28th, Vladimir Dudukin, age 73, was the 44th confirmed victim. December 6th, Nikolai Koryagin, age 72, became the 45th confirmed victim of Alex. December 16th, 05, Viktor Solovyev, age 49, was the 46th confirmed victim. On December 19th of 2005, Boris Grishin, age 64, became Alex's 47th confirmed victim. And on December 26th of 2005, Alexander Lyavochkin, age 51, was Alex's 48th confirmed victim. On February 27th, 2006, Yuri Ramashkin, age 55, was the 49th confirmed victim of Alex. On March 4th, Stepan Vasilenko, age 68, was the 50th confirmed victim accounted for. On March 24, 2006, Makhma Joldashev, age 24, was the 51st confirmed victim. On April 12th, Larissa Kligina, age 48, became Alex's 52nd confirmed victim. On June 14th of 2006, Marina Maskliava, aged 36, was the last and 53rd confirmed victim of the chessboard killer.
In June 2006, Alex offered to go for a walk with his 36-year-old co-worker, Marina Maskliava. Though she was reportedly suspicious of him, Marina agreed to go. Before she left, she wrote a note to her son letting him know she was with Alex and left Alex's phone number. Alex was aware of this note, but that did not stop him from killing. They are talking about something important as they walk through the park. What is love? Is love for real? Or is it a ruse? A make-believe ambrosia. The woman doesn't know. The maniac has had this conversation before. He has practiced. When he talks, he has an almost preternatural concentration. He wants to be understood, and he likes to say he never lies. In court, he will declare, "I always say exactly what I think." She had no idea he would be so serious. Alex, after all, is a clerk at the grocery store where they both work. He approached her maybe a half hour ago, started chatting, making jokes. He offered her a cigarette. She cupped it while he lit the match, then laughed at something he said. He suggested a walk in the park. She didn't know him all that well, but well enough, and she wanted another cigarette. So she accepted. Now they were walking over branches, wrappers, cigarette butts, past bottles, a stuffed animal, even a used condom. He's talking about intimacy of all things. During the trial, he'll have this to say about intimacy. The closer a person is to you, the better you know them, the more pleasurable it is to kill them. They can hear trails of moving laughter somewhere far away. Other people carousing, but here in this particular swath of woods, there are only trees and shadows. They can no longer see the road. He says something later, he will try to remember exactly what it was he said, and then he smirks. He sees something flash across her face, like many desperate pieces of information coalescing into an anticipation of what. She knows, of course, about the disappearances. Everyone does. By this point, spring 2006, something like 50 people have vanished into the woods. There are bodies, cops, sketches of suspects. She knows all about the park, the maniac, the faceless animal no one has seen or is even sure is one man or two or many. He is part of the daily chatter, coursing through the apartment blocks that ring about the park. They talk about him on TV every night. But the grocery clerk, now she seems certain that this man with sturdy hands and thick wrists, this co-worker, is the maniac. Suddenly she looks very, very tired. She throws her arms around a tree trunk and falls to the ground sobbing, squeezing her eyes shut tight. Alex is startled. How could she have known? There are pieces of bark pressed against her cheek, a scratch on her neck. She begins talking to herself. In court, he won't be able to recall what she is saying or trying to say, but he'll remember the moment with absolute clarity as the woman clings to the tree. He can't help it, but he smirks again. And when she says, "Are you going to kill me?" he has no choice but to reply, "Yes." This is a recollection of the night when Alex was with Marina. Marina's body was discovered in bits apart on June 14, 2007, complete with Alex's trademark injuries. Occasionally, he would sign the corpse by impaling the victim's skull with sticks or an empty vodka bottle. Now, he would even take a stick and he would smear his victim's brain matter all over the ground. This man is so freaking disgusting. Police stated it was like his calling card or signature of some sort. A Moscow Metro ticket found in her possession led authorities to review surveillance tape footage from the metro system, where she was filmed just hours before her death, walking on a platform, accompanied by Alex. This was his routine. He wanted his victim to know what was happening. Marina's son, before calling his father, rang Alex. Alex, after all, was supposed to be taking a stroll with his mother. But when he reached him, the maniac said, "I haven't seen her in 2 months," which was a strange thing to say about a woman he worked with every day. He lied, knowing everyone would know he was lying. Then he said he was busy and hung up. The simple fact is that Alex's desire to kill vastly exceeded the system's capacity to stop him, or even recognize that he existed. Had he hewed to his own routine, tossing his victims into sewage wells, Alex may never have been caught. It was only after the body started turning up in the forest that the Interior Ministry took over the case, and that people like Andrei Supranko, people who actually know how to find serial killers, started looking for him. Alex must have known the end was near. He must have sensed that the civil war inside him was reaching its apex, and that soon he would do something stupid, and they would find him. Now that corpses were appearing regularly, there were police, some in uniform, some in plain clothes, scouting the park 24 hours a day. They were narrowing their search, talking to everyone, compiling sketches of suspects. But in the very end, it was Alex's decision to get caught. All the victims' family members, the prosecutors, almost everyone with any connection to this case, say that Andre and his team did a superb job. But it was Alex who delivered Alex to the police. It's worth pointing out that the maniac, so proud of never lying, lied about killing Marina. There had been other lies, of course, countless tiny deceptions meant to lure his victims into the park. But no one who had ever asked Alex point blank if he had ever killed anyone. But then, 2 nights later, on July 16th, 2006, close to midnight, everyone at Alex's home was about to go to sleep when someone knocked at the door. This was strange. Usually you had to hit the buzzer to get into the building. Natasha, his mom, says she opened the door very slowly, and when she did, a column of men in uniforms pushed through the narrow corridor, crammed with jackets, and into the little bedroom living room where Alex was about to turn in for the night. In less than a minute, the apartment was flooded with armed riot police, boots, automatic rifles, handcuffs. "They were kind to me," she says. "They said they just wanted to talk to him about some burglaries, but I thought there were a lot of police for a burglar. I asked Alex, 'Did you rob someone?' And he said no." After Alex was escorted from the building, he did not resist. They gave his mom some documents stating exactly what he was being accused for. After that, she had a hard time saying anything. She couldn't even move. She couldn't focus. They stayed all night. The cops, detective, forensic experts, turning her home upside down, looking for things that might send her son to prison forever. This must have been devastating to his mother. It's like you don't even know who someone is. Andre, the detective, was a trim, balding man with a blonde mustache and large eyes is sitting behind his cluttered desk, wearing a black turtleneck and a charcoal jacket, smoking a lot. The investigator has a pro-teen personality that shifts quickly from irritable to angry to sarcastic. Asked why Alex preferred the woods, he says, "Have you ever tried killing someone in the street in broad daylight?" Andre spent months questioning the maniac and probably knows him better than anyone else, including Alex's family. "We were in shock when we realized how many people he killed," he says. "In the beginning, we only had 13 bodies, and then Alex began to tell us that he'd kill more than 60 people. Alex told him about the park, the sewage well, the entire MO. And Andre began to understand the fates of all these people who had disappeared. He wanted to talk," Andre says. "All psychopaths want to talk. They would sit in one of the holding cells, Andre on one side, Alex on the other. Under fluorescent lights, smoking, Alex wondered when he spoke, meandering in and out of his exploits. Andre says he always stared straight at Alex. It made him feel important, he says. I told him I admired him, and he liked that. And then he opened up. You know this was a lie. It was very important for Alex that people think he was a hero. So I made him feel like a hero. What emerged from months of plying Alex with sandwiches and cigarettes, months of pretending that he was an evil genius, was not the Hollywood-style maniac everyone had imagined, but an empty vessel. Someone no one could organize into a tidy psychological portrait. Even a chessboard killer is misleading. Andre believes because it suggests Alex would have stopped killing when he reached 64, the number of squares on a chessboard, as if his mission was to fill up a chessboard of death, as if he thought of murder as a game. Neither Andre nor anyone else close to the investigation believed this. Once apprehended, Alex led police officers to the scenes of many of his crimes in Vista Park and demonstrated a keen recollection of how the murders were committed. He was filmed reenacting his crimes in detail, a process which is a regular part of Russian criminal investigation.
Он завалялся вот так вот. Дальше я нанес ему еще несколько ударов. Ударов. Завалил.
Так.
Разбил. Вставил ему бутылку.
Так.
Водки.
Голову.
Вначале палки достал, потом все не подходило. Достал, не помню. Вставил бутылку. Кипел очень сильно. Даже когда уже мертвым был, сам. Здесь было, как бросил, что-то начал, щели не открою, что такое. А он его приподнял, заготовил, за ремень, по-моему, за что-то, штаны, заготовил. И вот так вот положил на половину. Затем поддел в ноги, и он полетел.
Понятно.
Ну и потом я услышал только крик там внизу. Человек на старушке все такое пошло.
Alex also revealed that some of the murders he committed were not done using his preferred method, hammer blows to the back of the head, but by throwing his victims down into the sewer lines beneath Vista Park, knowing they would drown. Eventually, some of the bodies turned up at a wastewater treatment center about 5 miles away, having floated through the network of underground tunnels. But it wasn't until much later, after those corpses had been disposed of, that the authorities connected them to the disappearances near Vista Park. Many bodies never turned up at all. At least 13 corpses, including possibly that victim of 32, are believed to be stuck somewhere in the sewage system. Alex preferred men. Only two, or possibly three, of his victims were women. Alex didn't want sex. He sought something pure, an untainted death. This is not to say that killing was not sexual for him. The way Alex talked about killing, he would tell the court that one's first murder is like a first love. Made it sound like a biological imperative. He said he even sometimes ejaculated when he would kill someone. Alex claimed that deciding whether his victims should live or die made him feel like God. In his own words, he said,
"In all cases, I killed for only one reason. I killed in order to live. Because when you kill, you want to live," he once said. "For me, life without murder is like life without food for you. I felt like the father of all these people, since it was me who opened the door for them to another world."
After his arrest, Alex happily confessed to his crimes, handing his diary over to police and showing them his most prized possession, a chessboard on which he had kept track of his murder victims. It was disappointing, he told them, that he hadn't completed it. Of the 64 squares, only 61 of them were filled in. As he aired his confession to the police, the number of victims changed over and over again. He first listed 48, then 49, then 61, and later said that it was as high as 63, but he lost count. Police considered his chess game evidence of 61 crimes, and the bodies they had located as evidence were only of 48 murders. Despite the data references, the police were only able to charge Alex with 48 counts of murder and attempted murder. Three of his victims survived. Like I said earlier, Alex was all about himself. He struggled with wanting to kill, but he also wanted to tell the world about his killings. So, what the police did to make him talk more and open up more about it, they promised him that he would be able to tell his story on air to millions of people in Russia. And this excited him so much. They even videotaped it, and he just sat there and talked and talked.
По словам Пичушкина, он убил 61 человека.
Я его просто удавил. Зажал рот, он все приподнял, положил на поручень. Так вот. И потом поддел ноги. И он туда руку. Потом там дикий крик такой. Ну и все, я спустился по лестнице. И все.
Пичушкин
уже его туда привел, зная заранее, что убьешь, или вот его, так сказать, громкий разговор, вот эти песни. Нет, знаю заранее.
Заранее, да?
И он мне нас, накрывшись какой-то тряпкой и храпел. Я подошел, приставил ручку к его темени, выстрелил, и получилась осечка. Я зарядил другой патрон. И вторым патроном не удалось.
Посмотрите, с какой невозмутимостью и безразличием Пичушкин рассказывает об убийствах.
Вначале храпел и лежал. После выстрела тут же замолк. Я так тряпочку эту откинул, посмотреть. Лежал, перестал храпеть, вообще каких-либо звуков не сдавать. Из головы у меня такая тонкая струйка. Я опять так накрыл аккуратно и ушел.
He thought he was live on TV, y'all, but they got his videotape confession. And I just think that it's so funny that he really thought he was talking to everyone in Russia. In this confession, he discussed at length his need to kill, showing no remorse. He later argued that he should be charged with more murders, keeping with his claim of killing 61 people. The hideous nature of his crimes has renewed interest in reinstituting Russia's death penalty.
On October 24th of 2007, Alexander Petrushkin was found guilty of murdering 48 people. Throughout the trial, he insisted that he had actually taken 61 lives, but authorities could muster evidence to prosecute him for only 4 dozen. He was sentenced to life in prison. Russia doesn't have the death penalty.
After a trial lasting 6 weeks, the jury takes less than 3 hours to return a unanimous verdict. And on Monday, October the 29th, 2007, Judge Vladimir Usov pronounces sentence.
Учитывая повышенную опасность совершенных преступлений, исключительно опасность для общества самого виновного, суд в целях восстановления социальной справедливости и предупреждения совершения новых преступлений считает необходимым назначить Петрушкину за совершение особо тяжких преступлений, повлекших массовую гибель людей, пожизненное лишение свободы.
The Russian state and the chief prosecutor are proud of the result.
Правосудие свершилось. Наказание назначено то, которого заслуживает обвиняемый.
Petrushkin will spend the rest of his life behind bars. The first 15 years will be in solitary confinement.
A week after his conviction, Petrushkin's attorney filed an appeal, requesting a more lenient sentence. During his trial, Alex was housed in a glass cage for his own protection. The hearing room was filled with television correspondents, newspaper reporters, internet scribes, flashbulbs exploded, a babushka wails, "Where is my body?" She's talking about her husband, who disappeared one night down a snowy path in the woods. The babushkas look uneasy in this place, a majestic building made of steel, glass, and marble. The judge asks Petrushkin if he wants to say anything. Нет, he says. No, there's nothing. And that's all he says during the whole proceeding. Pavel Ivanikov loosens his tie and asserts that even though his client has been convicted of some very seriously heinous crimes, the judges should have mercy and reduce the sentence to 25 years. He says what he has to say. The judges disappeared into their chambers. 45 minutes later, they reemerge and declare that the sentence stands. Petrushkin will never go free. Soon, he would be moved from his jail in Moscow, where his mother had been able to visit twice a month, giving him gifts of cigarettes, cheese, and salo, or salted lard, to a maximum security prison, probably in the north, or maybe in the Ural Mountains, where he will spend the first 15 years of his sentence in solitary confinement. They don't say where he'll be sent. Only his mother will know, and she will not be able to see him often. It will be at least a one-night train ride away. Upon conviction, Judge Vladimir Usov sentenced Petrushkin to life imprisonment, with the first 15 years to be spent in solitary confinement. At that point, everyone left the courtroom and the maniac was putting his hands behind his back, so someone that we can't see could handcuff him. He then disappeared. He was almost gone. Petrushkin repealed his sentencing, claiming it was too harsh and asked for that reduction to 25 years. As of 2017, Petrushkin was spending his days in solitary confinement at the Arctic penal colony Polar Owl. He now languishes inside impossible-to-escape Polar Owl penal colony at Carp Village in the Arctic north of Siberia, serving that life sentence, from which he will never be released. In winter, it's a furnace of cold, and in the brief, bleak summer, the marshmallowy tundra offers no route out, even if an inmate was to penetrate the ring of ravenous German shepherd dogs. Gray days, all impressions are bleak, all bright impressions left outside. The hardest thing, the inability to be in charge of myself. A slave dependence on Mr. Commander, it is hard to accept that it is a life sentence. My opinion is an illusory one, but I think that a life sentence is unnatural. He says he sees his murder victims in his dreams. I'm surprised that they are alive. I'm talking to them in the same way that I was talking in real life, and then kill them. There is no repentance, I am saying to you. If you let me out now, first of all, I will kill a couple of people, just to get rid of the stress. Then I will rape a woman and drink some vodka. And then we'll see how it goes. All of your religions are a lie. Evil rules this world. And I am realistic about the things. I thought it would not be fair to forget about the other 11 people. The first murder, it's like first love. It's unforgettable.
There appears to be some kernel of truth to this story. After the loss of his grandfather, Alex was depressed. He did get a dog that he often walked in the park. But it's unknown today whether the dog is actually buried there. There was total shock when we heard it. It was Alex, Natasha, a pale blonde woman of 27 years old whose father, Boris, was the 36th victim. He was always very calm, always by himself, Natasha, who has known Alex for years. Alex's half-sister, Katya, since they were little, attended all 46 days of her brother's trial. One night he was watching a memory of Alex's is that one night when he was watching TV with his mother and sister, and there was a report about the Bitsa Park killer, his sister exclaimed, "This madman, he's so fascinating. Who is he?" And Alex said that he had to fight very hard. He was practically bursting not to tell her. She was sitting right next to him. I wished I knew more about the victims, y'all. It just really breaks my heart. I knew some stories of them, but it's really hard to decipher Russia. And when I do try to Google about the victims and their life and all that, just nothing comes up. So I'm very sorry that I couldn't really go into more about who these lost souls were. Some people even said they thought it was strange that he only wanted to kill people he knew. If he had killed people he didn't know in another neighborhood, it wouldn't have been as bad. But he killed people he knew.
On the next day, he came over to relatives of the victim, who walked the streets with the photo of the victim, asking people if they saw him.
И подошел незнакомый парень. Не так весело, так это так, как бы не так. Не нашли еще, спрашивает. Я думал, либо живет здесь, потому что я давно здесь не жил, либо знал он его.
Bitsa killer was staring at the photo, act like he wants to help, but at the same time he enjoyed the fact that he only one who knows that that guy will never return home.
Yes, I did it. Yes, it was me. For everyone it was shocking. We thought he will at least say forgive me to those people whom he killed.
Которых он убил.
Вот он был отменный, я вам должен сказать. Отменный, вот он с людьми очень хорошо разговаривал на самом деле. Если ему что-то нужно было необходимо там от человека, он его прямо изнутри вытаскивал. Он говорит, ты что там на меня наболтал? Я говорю, ну знал, что знал, то и рассказал. Я говорю, я давно подозреваю, что ты какой-то не вполне нормальный стал. А встречались мы с ним на Битской конно-спортивный комплекс. Ну, знаете, там такие ступенечки там. Вот, и всякий раз, когда он ко мне, когда он с правой или с левой стороны там пытался на него подняться выше меня, я все-таки худо-бедно, но пересаживался все выше и выше. Потом сказал, я говорю, Саш, ты мне лучше, я говорю, не заходи мне там ни справа, ни слева. Я говорю, сядь либо рядом, либо вот так что мы с тобой нормально разговаривали.
Он usually looked up for a person used to alcohol.
С ним вообще общались?
Да, да.
Тоже общались?
Ну, так же, как только через это дело.
For Nikolai Fomin, the sentence provides justice for the cruel death of his son, Vladimir.
There is no punishment higher than life imprisonment. This is as much as you can get. So he will stay in jail for life.
Indeed, the maniac befriended people so he could kill them. That's very haunting. It's like he got more pleasure from it or something. That's just... Could you imagine someone living and killing people in your housing building? And you just don't even know who you live next door to. That is some scary shit. Natasha, his mother, says Alex never had any interest in girls, never talked about sex, or looked at women the way boys and men often look. She was asked whether Alex might be gay, but she shook her head firmly. Natasha is equally dismissive. She says, "My son was actually going to marry someone," she says. "Whom did he plan to marry?" She shrugs at this. She never met the bride-to-be. Andre, the police detective who led the investigation from the Prosecutor General's Department of Homicide and Armed Robbery in Moscow, also rules out the possibility that Alex is homosexual. He says Alex doesn't have any sexual longings for men. He just doesn't care about women. But there's something else. In Russia, which remains violently homophobic, it may be that people have a hard time believing a gay man is capable of the kind of power or force of will that defined the maniac. Alex is a maniac, and he's evil, and no one disputes this. But he is also very much a man in the way Russians think of men. He is, in fact, a frighteningly ordinary man. Rough, crude, a heavy drinker, a smoker, with no expectation that his life will ever get any better or easier. He expects to die in his late 50s, the average life expectancy for Russian men, who are prone to all kinds of self-abuse and have, at best, spotty health care. He doesn't have a career. He has a job. He is not exactly disdainful of those with goals. He is unaware there are any goals to have. In December 2007, an interview was taking place. Natasha is sitting on her son's bed in the family's apartment, and she is crying. She's a small woman, about 5'4", with dyed reddish purplish hair, a weak voice, and a sickliness that seems ironed onto her face. An odor, sweat, cooking oil pervades the apartment, which is cluttered with DVDs, old furniture, and an ancient refrigerator bearing two faded photographs of her son at age 8 or 9. On the other side of the narrow doorway, her grandson is playing video games that involve shooting barnyard animals. Natasha is saying that Alex, the maniac, used to be close to his nephew, but Sergei hasn't seen him in almost 18 months. And he's beginning to forget him. He used to ask, "Where's Alex?" she says. But now he doesn't. He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know who he is. She takes out Alex's collection of commemorative pins, which look like the kind of souvenirs any boy growing up in the Soviet Union might collect. There are pins commemorating the 1980 Olympics in Moscow, Tolstoy pins, Lenin pins, a pin from Minsk, 92 pins in all. "You should take them," she says. "What can I do with these things?" She's trying to describe her son. She stresses how ordinary he was. She said he had a cat named Mursik and a fish tank. That he loved the TV adaptation of Andre, Dumbest Countess of Mursul. During the trial, Alex said He sometimes had to hurry up and finish someone off so he could rush home and shower, in case scrubbing the blood out of his hair or from under his fingernails, to be able to watch the latest installment of Countess, usually with his mother. She says he's very brave. Echoing her son, she says he never lies. Then she tells a story about a lie he once told. One night, Alex announced he was going to walk in the park. There were men disappearing almost every week back then, and she and his half-sister pleaded with him not to go. Alex said he wasn't scared of any maniac. Does she know why her son became a serial killer? Could it have been his father's abandonment of the family? Did something happen when he was little? These are the questions that keep surfacing and resurfacing. They are impossible questions, but they are the only ones that really matter now. And every time they come up, Natasha cries and shakes her head and stares through a window at the darkened courtyard below. I know now that I raised my son very poorly, she says. I can't say what I did wrong. I just tried to raise him like a normal mother. She glances at the photographs on the refrigerator. In both pictures, he stares straight at the camera, unsmiling. She covers her face. After a long time, she looks up and turns her gaze to the television set. Finally, she says, I think I didn't know my son very well.
In the end, the maniac was what his mother and Supranenko say he was. Ordinary. He didn't have strong opinions. He lacked preferences or ideas about other people. God, art, beauty. He could talk about these things, and did, but these were simply words in the service of killing. They were bits of theater. They were nothing. Valentine's Day 2008. The maniac is in a cell on a closed caption screen, laughing, posing, unwittingly in his televised cage. Actually, there are 5 television screens, 4 medium-sized sets, and 1 large flat screen. Except for his mother and Supranenko, almost everyone else is here at the recently renovated Supreme Court of Russia on Pavarskaya Street in the center of Moscow. Natasha, his mom, Pichushkin's lawyer, Pavel Ivanikov, the panel of 3 judges, the prosecutor in his royal blue military-style uniform, the babushkas who lost sons and husbands, the younger men and girls whispering into their cell phones, too scared to look at this maniac, who looks bored, and then amused, and then angry. He never looks directly at the video camera in his cell. He's talking to someone that we can't see. With his black button-down shirt and black t-shirt, he almost looked fashionable. He laughs for a moment. His laughter is brief and infrequent, and then the grin morphs into a frown, which morphs into a look of incredulity, which morphs into another stare. Now he's talking, but it is impossible to make out what he's saying.
The serial killer, so sadistic without any remorse, yet has become a magnet for women while around 80 are riding him in prison. One Siberian woman who works in a children's shop has won a special place in his heart, and she even calls her Natalia Pishkushkin, as if they are already married. He admitted recently in an interview with a Russian newspaper that he had proposed to her, and she accepted. Age 29, Natalia also has finally spoke up to explain her obsession with Alex, even though they had only ever communicated by letter and never met. She angrily denied recently reports that she had ditched him, complaining instead that their letters between the pair had been blocked by the authority for 2 years. Nothing has changed since he proposed to me, she said, calling him Sasha, the fond name for Alexander, whose image she has tattooed on her arm. Whatever people say, I love him more than life itself. It never crossed my mind to part with him. I have not received Sasha's letters in recent years, but we both know that it does not depend on us. Employees of the institution where he is serving his sentence do not want us to communicate. She complained, I don't know what I have done or why they do this to me. He is my everything. I have nothing in this world without him. I am dead without him. When they cut our correspondence, I sent him dozens of letters. They all remained without answer. I just live in hope that we will be allowed to communicate. She had previously written to other jailed killers before striking up a correspondence with Alex, starting in 2009 when she was 22. To her surprise, the mass murderer wrote back. He replied, correspondence followed between them after 2 years. I realized I had fallen in love. I have had no special feelings for my other pen friends. She claimed Sasha had created such a stir not only in our country but throughout the world. If you hear my sarcasm, she's disgusting. But so I was curious to know what he really is like. It turned out that he was not so bad as shown in the media. Every psychopath lives two lives. In one body consists two completely opposite personalities. I managed to get rid psychologically of my thoughts that I was dealing with a killer, and I loved what I see behind this. She said he had many women pen friends. He is very popular among women, especially among those who lived abroad. You should have seen what stupidities they write in social media communities that are dedicated to him. I had been hiding my feelings. In fact, I did not even dare think that such a man would ever pay even some attention to me. After all, who am I and who he is? I do not remember how and when I confessed my love for the first time. It was me who took the first step. That's for sure. What does he say of her? I proposed to Natalia. It was spontaneous, he said this year, but I proposed to her like a man should do. She immediately agreed. Maybe if I were free, I would not have paid any attention to her, but there she is, the ideal for me. I have been here since 2008, and I need her. We started communication, and now I know 100% about her. We were not allowed to meet, he said. I am saying I know her, I feel her, and now they don't allow us to exchange letters. At first they did, but not now. Divorcee Natalia admitted, my relatives were initially shocked. I understand them. Over time, they reconciled and accepted my choice. It's okay now. She has also faced outrage from her public comments about her love for the monster, stemming from her participation in a television documentary 2 years ago. She replies to this criticism, I'm not a maniac. I have not the slightest interest in murdering people. She implies he has changed, even though Alex himself denies this. I do not share the interest of the old Alex, she says. I'm not going to hurt anyone. I do not consider myself a bad person, but if you hit me, I will hit back. Natalia acknowledges he committed terrible things, I admit, but she goes on absurdly to argue that no one can blame him except relatives of the victims. This woman, this is a case just between him and them. All others simply do not have the right to open their mouths. Y'all, I want to say so much right now that I'm having trouble. I am getting really sassy right now. She was married for 9 years to an alcoholic, she said. I'm 29. I was in marriage for 9 years. But my ex-husband was an alcoholic. He treated me in a way I did not deserve. He now asks me to come back now and says that he understands everything. But, yeah, there's no way I'm going back. I have never been deprived of male attention, even after I took on the role of a villain in society when her obsession with Alex became clear. Men continued to pay attention to me. Someone else in my place would have committed suicide long ago if they had to cope with my dubious fame. Psychologically, it was not easy to endure all this. But Alex knew that I withstood everything, and this is why, probably, he proposed to me. She said he warned me about the negative consequences. He has to think a lot before I gave an answer to his proposal. All this I knew, but could not refuse him. I'm not afraid of him. It is worthless to argue with him. So I agreed with everything. Told by a journalist that no woman with a healthy mind could fall for a mass killer. But she says, many people think so. I have a lot of enemies, but also a lot of supporters. There's so many opinions. In such cases, I always remember the saying, do what you want, you will be condemned for the rest of your life anyways. She was reminded in his recent interview, her maniac had said that if he was released tomorrow, he would immediately kill a couple of people just to get rid of stress. Then I will rape a woman and drink some vodka. She replied, he does not say anything without a reason. Once he told me that he would never hurt his own family, I believe him. And about rape? I think he was joking. I have talked to him about it. He has never been a proponent of sexual violence. She said that the Science Center for Social and Forensic Psychiatry had identified disorders in him. Homicide mania, personality disorders, alcoholism. But this did not prevent him tricking the police for 15 years, she said. He is a very clever and cunning man who thought every action through 2 steps ahead and always had at least 3 fallback positions in case something went wrong. He is a psychopath. He cannot, in principle, be stupid or crazy. Almost 30. She now wants a child, she said. She doubts Alex and her can ever be physically close. Otherwise, I could have given birth to his child. No one will ever allow this of me, deprived of the chosen father of her child. She is ready to find a father and freedom for her future baby, and says the mass killer agrees to this. I'll have to pick up a man for this year. In freedom, she said. I'm almost 30. I do not want to feel flawed, so I need a child. It's not a problem to find a sperm donor. Alex understands all this and supports me. I will always belong to Alex. But she complained he was being treated differently to other long-term inmates, including murderers. She blames the TV programs which highlighted on her love for him, which created too much noise. Dating weddings are allowed to all prisoners, but not him. There's too much noise around him. I don't deny that our case is different, but why does the public react to his story like savages? She claimed her interest in serial killers began from childhood. My friend still played with the dolls, and I already knew by heart the biography of Chikatilo. That was the serial killer Alex idolized, but that serial killer was executed in 1994. In high school, I began to correspond with so-called one-time murderers, though who killed only once. It was interesting to communicate with them to learn their world. Then my correspondence with them was not enough for me. I wanted something hotter. Ew, I can't believe I had to just read that. I began to seek communicate with real maniacs. I wanted to understand them, talk to them. Many people have asked me if this scared me. No, I was not scared. Over the years, I continued to learn all kinds of stuff about the serial killers. Now I'm like a walking encyclopedia. I can tell you about any of them. And I have been corresponding with many well-known serial killers. Remember the movie Silence of the Lambs, where the investigator during interviews felt sympathy to the main villain? In fact, maniacs are very interesting people. Each of them is unique and original. These are people with a different outlook. It's interesting with them. They differ from the gray mass. They are better and smarter than any of us. That's not right. The story of Alex caused a great resonance in society. There was a lot of noise. I started looking for anything that was published in the media on this subject. I watched all the TV programs about it, and then everything has been studied. I decided to find the address of the prison where he was sent, but to find where he was sent to serve his sentence was unreal. This information was not published anywhere. When she discovered his jail, my joy knew no bounds. She also got to know the maniac's mother. I remember when we met for the first time in the subway, she grabbed my hand and immediately pulled me to her home, said Natalia. I was so touched. She hugged me, opened up. I immediately became kind of a relative to her. She's a wonderful person. Her love would be enough for children, grandchildren, daughters-in-laws. From our conversation, I realized that she still loved her son. Yet, she also said that Alex... Yet, she said that Alex's mother, 64, at this time, stopped writing her son. She explained it, saying it was heavy for her to receive his letters. It is better to be deceived into thinking she had never had a son, and none of this had happened. It is much easier. Natalia said she never opposed our marriage, but Natalia admits she faced a barrage of abuse of her love choice. In 2014 documentary, she posed in a wedding dress as Alex's bride, highlighting her love for the savage mass murderer. Everything changed for me when they showed the Bista maniac on TV. She said, it was love from first sight. He became my ray of sunshine. I began writing. He answered, and we exchanged letters. In his letters, he told me in detail about the murders he committed and how it was interesting for him to turn the living into the dead. She added, I go to bed thinking about him. I wake up thinking about him. To her, he was like a Hollywood star. After the TV show, she said, when I returned home, I was showered with numerous threats, insults. Tons of mud from around the country poured out on my head. Before my public confession, everyone treated me normally, even though at the time I had been corresponding with Alex for a few years. I did not change after I met him. Of course, I did not expect that people would be against me so much. Our city is not evil in general. Only a handful of my friends turned away from me. But I do not need friends like them. Believe me, I did not become worse because I love the man who is believed to be a devil. I knew that neither nor my choice would be approved. But it was a surprise to get such a dramatic wave of negativity. At some point, I was afraid to go out, but I got used to it over time. I remember people were shouting in the social networks that they are afraid to live in the same city as me, and that I should be isolated from society. Also, I did read somewhere that in 2016, she actually got to meet Alex in person, and they got married. For real. People, I do not condone dating or talking to serial killers. I feel pitiful for this girl. She has a very dark way of thinking. And I just felt like if she was coerced into killing people, she probably would. Because if she doesn't see that there's something wrong with her husband that did it, that killed a lot of innocent people, there's something wrong with her mentally. I just can't wrap my mind around the women that fall in love with a serial killer. It must be like the bad boy stigma or something. I don't know. Bad choices. My opinion about this horrible man is that there was something he lacked. He had no empathy. He had no remorse. He had a brain injury. A lot of these serial killers have some type of injury of the brain. And I'm telling you, there's something about it. This case, or this horrific time in Russia, has been done a whole bunch. I have talked so much, my voice, I feel like I'm losing my voice now. I am so grateful for As the Raven Dreams to help me out. He has read a whole bunch too. This case is huge. just all the people that this asshole murdered. I'm just so happy that some people survived. And it upsets me so bad that the people that survived were just, oh, shut up. Just go to the corner. Don't worry. Don't worry. It was so crazy that they didn't even believe them. And that's why that the regular police department, or however they call it there, could not handle this case. And I'm happy that they turned it over to the professionals, because it was getting out of control. And I am very disappointed in that one officer that told Maria to just not worry about it. He pushed her down a fucking well to her death. What the fuck? And she was almost 8 months pregnant. Thank God her and her baby are safe. All the people that unfortunately lost their lives way too soon, just because they were weak, were hunted like animals. I mean, he was only 18 when he committed his first murder, and then he was, what, 32 when he got arrested? And he would lure them out, and then manipulated people so bad.
Well, now that we get into the segment of thoughts and opinions on this case, this man was an absolute monster. An absolute blight, a stain on how far our society has progressed. The number of victims that this man took is astronomical. The fact that some of these murders happened within days of each other is mind-boggling. I understand that Russia is not the United States, and they do things very differently. And I understand that there is a bit of a history of corruption within their police force. But the fact that this man could kill so many people in such a short amount of time and never once be caught and never once be pulled in beyond his first victim to be questioned, to be interrogated, it is with an absolute lack of better words on my part, insanity. I'm not a person that believes that people are born evil, but this man alone, this single man, honestly, has me second-guessing my own mentality whenever it comes to that fact. Maybe people aren't born evil, but every once in a while, you get one that truly is. Obviously, my hearts go out to every person who knew all of these victims, which that number is, again, astronomical. This is a strange thing for me to say because I don't generally give my opinion on these kinds of things, but I am glad that this man will never be free again. He doesn't deserve to see the sun. He doesn't deserve anything beyond solitary confinement. And, in my opinion, he's not even worth that. I won't say anything beyond this because I don't want to pull this into an overtly negative statement or say something I shouldn't say on YouTube, obviously, but this man is a monster. And I'll stop there. Full stop. This man is a monster.
I wanted to say I'm so sorry to the families that lost their loved ones. And I do want to say that I am very proud of that fought and survived. Next month, I am not sure what case I am going to do. Please stay safe. I love you all so much. Also, about 90% of y'all are not subscribed to my YouTube channel. And if you're not subscribed and you actually like the video that y'all have been watching, it won't pop up on your feed. You have to go searching for me. To Lady Curious, and also subscribe to Raven Investigates. Sometimes I do special videos for Raven Investigates that are only on that channel and are never seen on Lady Curious. So please, down below, you'll see both of the channels connected to the channel that I have this uploaded to. You can even hit that little bell icon. Thank you so much to my colleague for helping me with this. And he is a very good friend, and he is an amazing narrator. Please go over to his channel. It's called As the Raven Dreams, and subscribe. You will not be sorry. He does really awesome videos. Like, he does scary stories, true stories. He does dark web video stories. He also does weird things happening in the Matrix. So yeah, go check him out. Love y'all so much. Until next time, stay safe.
Я вот так перевоплощался, как бы. То есть надо было понять, что человек, а потом подстроиться под него. Мне не только важно было умертвить саму плоть, но мне важно было вот это, осознать все вот это.
Собственно, со второго трупа всех остальных я под этим предлогом вывалил.
Моя рука хорошо помнит молоток.
Convicting Petrushkin had taken 9 months strenuous work. It had been very hard and stressful, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, an awful lot of work. And I shall never forget it. Well, for me it was the most serious case in my career. I have faced serial killers before, but none of them was such a cruel and ruthless murderer. As Petrushkin.
Жестоко, как Петрушкин.